This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. Rewilding is one of those slightly problematic terms that means different things to different people. It's a term which is, to be honest, evolving. Peter Cairns is the Executive Director of Scotland The Big Picture, an organisation which supports rewilding in this country. Now, I met up with them recently, close to the River Feshy near Kincraig, and as we wandered along the riverbank, Peter explained to me his vision for the organisation.
I suppose the very, very basic idea is more nature. You call that rewilding, call it nature recovery, call it ecological restoration, call it what you will. But fundamentally, Scotland, the UK, finds itself in a situation where, you know, we're one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world. Bizarrely, we're also one of the best educated and most affluent countries in the world. So to find ourselves in that position is really odd, but that is the case. And we'd like to try and do our bit to help arrest and reverse that process.
The fact that we are one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world is going to come as a surprise to many, because we're known for our wildlife.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this comes under the sort of general banner of, I don't know what you call it really, ecological illiteracy, ecological blindness. And I think, you know, it's a human trait that we all become comfortable and familiar with the landscape we're born into, and we accept that as normal. We know no different. And I think it's a relatively recent phenomenon whereby people have started to, I suppose, become more ecologically aware, better educated perhaps, and are starting to question the status quo and looking at the landscape in Scotland through a different lens.
Just describe this landscape to me, because, I mean, you are a photographer, you have an artist's eye. This is fantastic.
It's a challenge to say to people, on the one hand, you know, this is a dramatic and beautiful landscape, and it absolutely is. And of course, Scotland's tourism product is produced on the back of that, if you like. But ecologically speaking, it is a landscape that has lost all its large carnivores, most of its large herbivores. And, you know, we're walking through a little bit of regenerating native woodland here. But, it, you know, native woodland across the whole of Scotland represents only 3% of its original range. So, yeah, on many, many fronts, ecologically speaking, Scotland is depleted or diminished.
Okay, we are in a broad river valley. There are mature trees standing in front of us. I can see things like silver birch, for example. Across the other side of the valley, probably across the other side of the river, you know, the hills rise up, there's scree slopes there, there's coniferous plantation, there are patches of heather that you can actually see really purpling up at the moment. Really pretty. What should this look like?
Well, I try not to advocate for what it should look like, because if you ask 100 people what it should look like, you get 100 different answers. I suppose the question is, what could it look like? And I think what it could look like is with more life, a greater abundance and diversity of life. And by life, you know, I'm talking not only about the sort of charismatic megafauna, as it were, I'm talking about insects and vegetation, plants, flowers, shrubs, trees, etc., etc. We could have, relatively easily, with a change of mindset, a greater abundance and diversity of life in the round.
Okay, how?
Well, you look around this landscape, you'll probably know Glen Feshy is one of the relatively few places in Scotland where ecological restoration has been taking hold for, what, 20, best part of 20 years now. And you're seeing a lot more vegetation emerging from the ground, literally emerging from the ground, young trees, young shrubs, flowers, much more diversity. And in Glenfeshi's particular case, this is not the case everywhere, but in Glenfeshi's particular case, that's come about primarily as a result of a reduction in grazing pressure. So in other words, they've reduced the impact, the intensive impact through grazing on the land, stood back, allowed it to breathe, allowed it to govern itself, and now you've got this emerging mosaic of habitats.
And how did they do that? How did they reduce the grazing pressure?
Well, fundamentally, removing sheep, which was some time ago. And then, I mean, you'll be familiar with the story around the huge cull of red deer in 2003, 2004.
That was a compulsory cull. It caused a lot of upset at the time.
Huge amount of upset. And even now, you know, people are resentful of the fact that it happened, why it happened, etc. So, I witnessed that, photographed it, documented it. It was a contentious time. There's no doubt about it. However, 15, 17 years on, walking in this glen, whether you like the change or not, nobody can deny the impact. Nobody can deny the cause and effect. It's very obvious to anybody.
Just to give a bit of historical context to that, the estate had been asked to reduce deer numbers on numerous occasions and hadn't. And eventually, it was decided that it should be done compulsorily. So teams were sent in. There was a helicopter involved. That was hugely contentious too, because it just didn't fit with the whole zeitgeist of how deer are normally shot and handled afterwards and things. Yeah. I remember talking to keepers afterwards who were literally, I mean, grown men, literally in tears. Yeah. They were so upset by it.
Yeah, absolutely. I can remember that too. And I understand that. I think, you know, the way this landscape has been shaped predominantly by human activity over millennia, certainly over centuries, you know, that's deeply entrenched, it's deeply ingrained, and many people in Scotland feel a deep sense of identity with that with that process. And you could argue, you know, the sort of the beginning of this chapter goes back to Victorian times. So this is something that's been going on a couple of hundred years. I suppose at the end of the day, it comes back to not so much to what the landscape should look like, but what could it look like. And, you know, I think people like me would question whether the status quo, the sporting tradition, intensive sheep farming, whatever it happens to be, is relevant to the needs of 2022 and wider society. Could we do things differently in a way that would bring a greater range of benefits to a greater range of people?
I remember talking to the late Dick Bilharry and asking him, where in Scotland is there an example of the kind of thing that you have been espousing your entire life? And he said Glenfeshi. But it's where you can see most clearly what is possible.
Yeah, I think Glenfeshi is one example. Maybe Glenafric is another. Right. Gives you an insight into what Scotland could look like. I mean, even since Dick's death, there are a number of emerging initiatives where you're starting to see the infancy of regeneration or regrowth. And another one might be Carafran down in the Borders. So you're starting to see the beginning of what is a decades-long or even centuries-long process taking hold. But in the meantime, yeah, I think Glenfeshi and Glenafric, probably the two most celebrated examples of what that restoration process could look like.
Yeah. We've kind of come out of the trees now and we're just overlooking the river itself. It's pretty dry this time of year.
It really is dry. And I think, you know, that's a relevant point because, of course, rewilding is not only about fluffy animals and trees. It's also about so-called ecosystem services. What is this river doing in terms of delivering benefits or disbenefits to people? And one of the things, of course, with the Feshi and the Spey catchment generally is the potential for flooding. And it's interesting, and I, you know, I can't evidence this. Don't get me wrong. I can't evidence this. But over the last 20 years or so, the vegetation across the riverbed is really starting to emerge. So you can see young gorse, broom, alder trees, willows, young pines on the opposite side of the river. They are changing the way that this river behaves. And it's inevitably altering the flow of the river as well. And also benefiting, I would argue, benefiting the survival of species like salmon. So it's not just about pine martins or pine trees or, I don't know, pine hoverflies. It's also about what the restoration of this river catchment will do for people.
There's about, I don't know, 80 metres of dry riverbed in front of us. There's a bit of a stream there. Can we actually access the river from here anyway?
Yeah, we can walk across.
Okay,
yeah.
Come on. In the middle of the stone bed, there are tree stumps. And somebody has been building these little stone cairns on top of the stumps. It's astonishing how popular that's become.
Yeah, yeah. In many ways, it's quite symptomatic, isn't it? Over, you know, we feel as though we have to kind of exert some sort of influence on the landscape. We kind of feel it's maybe not even an opportunity, it's almost an obligation, I guess. We find it very difficult to leave things alone in nature, I think. When this river is in spate, it's a paddling pool at the moment, but it's absolutely incredible the amount of material that it moves. Uh-huh. Sand, shingle, trees. It's astonishing how it can be transformed from something like this into literally a raging torrent.
What Scotland the Big Picture wants to do in terms of renaturing, of putting stuff back into the landscape and things, can it only be done on this scale?
No, I think, you know, there's a lot of what I would call misconceptions around rewilding. One of them is that it's all about wolves and getting rid of people. I sincerely hope we're past that by now. But the other thing is that it's something that's only for the big NGOs and the wealthy philanthropists like Anders Paulsen, etc. I would argue that nature recovery at different scales and across different settings can happen, you know, across our farmland, across our towns and cities, as well as in the more remote areas of the Highlands. So whether you call it rewilding or nature recovery or restoration, whatever, I'm not precious about that. But I think there's something that we can all do in our own space to afford nature the opportunity to recover. So this is on a landscape scale, as you say, but that doesn't preclude somebody with a relatively small garden in Edinburgh, for example, doing their bit.
How are you getting access to chunks of landscape? Who's helping you at the moment? Who's on your side?
I'm always nervous about sides because I don't think that necessarily helps the
All
divide.
Right. Who agrees with you then?
Okay, who agrees? Let me, on a practical level, we run a thing called the Northwoods Rewilding Network. We didn't really set out to orchestrate that. It came to us. These were farmers and crofters coming to us saying, I want to do my bit. I want to get involved in nature recovery. Can you help? So we designed the project over a couple of years. We now have 50 land partners covering about 15,000 acres across Scotland. These are not big eco-philanthropists. These are normal people coming at it for a range of reasons. Yes, some of them just want to do their civic duty, if you like, to give back to nature, to society. Some of them are doing out of economic reasons. Some of them are doing it because I can think of a farmer down in Fife who's coming up to retirement age. He wants to give the farm over to his daughter. He wants to do that in a healthy state ecologically, but also in a healthy state economically. So I think people are coming to this rewilding table, if you want to call it that, for a whole range of different reasons and at different scales and across different settings.
You mentioned earlier the fact that, you know, our big carnivores and herbivores, essentially a lot of them are gone. So what would you like to see reinstated? How would you go about doing it?
Our version of rewilding, our definition of rewilding is restoring ecosystem health, function and completeness. And if you set off at that sort of level of ambition, then completeness inevitably involves all of the species that helped shape this landscape originally. So that does involve all of the large predators. How do you do it? With great difficulty, there's no doubt about that. We're running a project at the moment looking to return lynx, which is probably the most sort of, if you like, most palatable, least contentious species. But that in itself is not without its challenges, obviously. My thinking on this is that very often it's not about lynx or beavers or trees even, it's about change. And it's about who is advocating that change and for what reasons. So I think rewilding, people who are averse to rewilding, this is a broad brush generalization, but people who are averse to rewilding tend to be resistant to change, especially if they feel that change is being forced upon them. But by people like me, you know? So we have to respect people's resistance to change. We have to respect people's cultural belief systems. It would be pointless for me or anybody from my community to force lynx, for example, on Scotland, because the first thing they're going to do is shoot them. You know, we're going to be back to square one.
If you can find them.
Well, if you can find them, that's a different thing. But you're never going to take everybody with you. Of course you're not. But I think we've got to get to a stage where if lynx do come back, it's in people's own terms and in people's own timescale. Now, that's a pipe dream. We're never going to get universal consensus. But if we can get majority agreement that this is a good thing ecologically, and arguably economically, then that opens the pathways to other possibilities.
I'm trying not to smile here because I think it was 2016. We were across in Norway and we were talking to a farmer there. And Ewan mentioned the fact that a lot of people want to see lynx reintroduced into the countryside here in Scotland. And for the first time, his eyes became as wide as saucers. And he suddenly discovered his English and he said, "Are you insane?"
Yeah.
You know, because he was a sheep farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
It was his concern.
Yeah, yeah. I think, yeah, I mean, I hear that. I see that a lot. I think Norway is a little bit of a misleading example of living alongside lynx. Well, politically speaking, the farming lobby is very strong. There is a practice in Norway whereby sheep get grazed inside forests, which is not the case in Scotland, mm-hmm. and it's not the case across most of Europe. And the roe deer populations, which is lynx's main prey, are relatively low. So you get a perfect storm. You get lynx that are hungry, and you get sheep that are in lynx habitat, and then you get a compensation system which actually, without being overly cynical, encourages claims. So all of those things into the pot makes the situation in Norway specifically look much less realistic as a comparison to what would happen in Scotland. If you want to know what would happen in Scotland, I don't know fully. Of course, nobody does until you do it. But you should perhaps look at somewhere like Switzerland or Germany in terms of the system that they operate, where lynx have very, very little impact on human activity.
Yeah.
That's not to say zero, but it's to say much less than is either the case or is perceived to be the case in Norway.
It's interesting, if you look back across the history of environmentalism, you know, the one big lesson that always jumps out for me is how really, really, really rubbish we are as a species at actually being able to do the job of other species.
Yeah.
You know, to a certain extent, it's not till the mix comes back together again that the machine starts working properly.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. I think it's a point that we would agree with. If I was a deer stalker, for example, I might be saying, well, look, you know, I'm perfectly capable of controlling deer, which at one level, of course, they are. These are experts in their field. But it doesn't replicate the natural processes. It doesn't replicate the ecological complexity that is created by the process of natural predation. And just by one example, yes, OK, you might shoot a red deer and leave the Gralloch on the hill, for example. But it happens seasonally, of course, and it happens kind of selectively. Lynx and wolves and bears across Europe, they do it randomly, routinely, 24/7, 365. So you've got much more of a dynamic relationship between predators and their prey, and therefore the scavengers that help themselves to carcasses, and the whole nutrient cycling that goes with the act of predation. So, you know, if you're asking me where the sort of glue is missing, if you like, in Scotland's ecology, yes, it's individual species, but it's also the processes that relate those species together: predation, scavenging, birth, death, decay, regeneration, the processes that drive, you know, the engine that you referred to. And I think that's something that we're particularly, I hesitate to use the word uneducated, we're perhaps a little bit ecologically illiterate, I guess. And that's, you know, that's not just in Scotland, that's across the whole of the UK, if not the Western world.
The example that's usually thrown up is the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone. A lot of concern about that, a lot of ranchers very, very unhappy about it. But there was lots and lots of unintended consequences there, some of which were good, some of which to the ranchers were not so good. One of the good things was that deer started behaving like deer again. They became much flightier. There were fewer of them, yes, but they were also fitter.
Yeah.
Because they were constantly on the lookout for what might potentially be a threat.
Yeah.
They started behaving the way that they had behaved, say, 5,000 years previously.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the fear factor, as it's called, does play a part. And again, it's a natural process, moving deer around the landscape, not necessarily because they're being predated, but because they fear being predated. And that is, to some degree, replicated with stalking. I'm sure there are stalkers listening to this going, well, we do that. And you're seeing that in Glenfeshie. Glenfeshie is not bereft of deer, contrary to popular opinion, but the deer are moving around much more. They're much more secretive because they sense they're being targeted. So, yes, humans can replicate those processes to a certain degree, but we'll never do it with the ecological authenticity, if you like, that nature would.
How do you keep people in the picture?
By talking to them, actually more accurate to say by listening to them. And I think conservationists, and I, you know, hesitate to put myself in that under that tribal label, but conservationists have been really good at telling people what to think. And normally that only gets one reaction. So we've got to get cannier about how we discuss some of these pretty uncomfortable conversations. Climate change, rewilding, species reintroduction, food production. We're living in a very, very fluid time at the moment where we've come to a crossroads on many of these fronts. We've got to be respectful of other people's opinions. You're never going to get universal consensus, but we've got to get better at listening respectfully, having progressive conversations, looking towards solutions rather than pointing the finger of blame. And conservationists have been really, really bad at that in the past. So yeah, I think we have to have these conversations in a more healthy, progressive framework than we've done in the past. Easier said than done, I know, but we've got to start.
Say we made you king for however long it took, and you could do exactly what you wanted to do. How would this place look differently? What would be in this environment? What would be in this landscape that doesn't exist now?
I suppose it's a bit of a twee answer, I guess, but more...
No, it was a twee question, so fair enough.
I suppose more space and freedom for nature to shape and govern this landscape as it sees fit. That doesn't mean excluding people, but it perhaps means a different mindset, so that we don't see nature as something to be continually extracted from. It's not a resource that is just there to serve us. It can serve us, but I think we've used it as a commodity. And I think, you know, we need to turn a switch off in our minds that has a different reimagined relationship with nature. So in 20, 30 years, I would like to see more scrub, more woodland, more restored peatlands, more space for water, more standing water. I suppose just less controlled, and let's just see how natural processes pan out, what it does to the river, what it does to the river catchment in the whole, what that does to salmon populations in the river. We are a species that love tinkering, love managing, love gardening. And even in that, you know, I'm saying that even in the conservation world, we kind of pick and mix conservation almost.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, rather than looking at the individual components of the engine, we've got to think about the health of the and the functionality of the engine as a whole.
And if we'd managed somehow to take a hot air balloon up at night and we're floating across this landscape with thermal imaging goggles or whatever it is, what would we be seeing below us in the trees walking along the shoreline?
If I'm honest, if I'm true to my word, then or true to the objectives that Scotland Big Picture works to, then we would be seeing lynx, we would be seeing potentially wolves. We might even be seeing bears. There's no ecological reason why bears couldn't exist in this landscape. Maybe not today, but in 30, 40 years' time with an improvement in habitat. Overall, we'd be seeing a greater abundance and diversity of life. You know, that can start from the mosquito up to the top predator. And included in that is people. There is no reason why there can't be more people living in these glens alongside healthy ecosystems and both benefiting from each other. There's no reason that can't happen other than, you know, what goes on in our heads and the limitations we place upon ourselves.
You said earlier, I think it was Northern Woodlands, that you now have 15,000 acres in there, which sounds like a lot, but in comparison with the whole of Scotland, it isn't. It's actually a very, very small amount.
Yeah.
People talk about a successful business model has the potential scalability. You have to be able to scale these things up. How do you take your ideas and scale them up Scotland-wide?
How does rewilding pay? That's a completely valid question. And if I'm honest, I can give examples of how it's paying for certain land holdings across the whole of the country. But there's no blueprint that's down yet. And we've got the whole controversy around sort of green lairdism and carbon investment and all of that. That's a different story. But how does rewilding pay? How does rewilding replace, if you like, or even enhance traditional farming or sport shooting activities? So that is an open-ended question. There's an emerging narrative around that, and I think it's an evolving process. But that does remain a question. So fiscal support is one thing. But I think if you drill it right down, this comes down to mindset. This comes down to value, people's values, people's belief systems, what they believe to be right or wrong, who they are, what they stand for. All of these fundamental traits that we all have start to dictate how receptive people are or are not to rewilding. And you know, by rewilding, I also mean to change.
In order to get a sort of bigger catchment area, you're going to have to educate. You're going to have to bring the politicians on board. You have to have political support.
Yep.
You have to have finance, as you say. You have to bring in all the various bodies.
Yeah. I mean, that is happening. Is it happening quickly enough, big enough for me? No, but it is happening. And if you look at the narrative, for example, in the new draft Scottish Biodiversity Strategy, the language in there is unrecognisable compared to what it would have been just three, certainly 5 years ago. So they might not use the word rewilding, but they are starting to talk about, you know, ecological networks, natural processes, ecological restoration at a landscape scale. This sort of language is starting to be used now. The level of ambition is definitely creeping up because, apart from anything else, you know, the Scottish Government have publicly declared that the climate emergency is inextricably linked to the biodiversity emergency. You can't fix one or the other, you've got to fix both.
You know as well as I do, that, I mean, you mentioned green lairdism earlier, that people are adopting rewilding as a flag and waving it, you know, and sort of saying, look, you know, we're doing wonderful things here, etc. Yeah. The trouble is, it means different things to different people. It's like sustainability.
Yeah.
What sustainability means to you might be completely different to me.
Yeah.
How do you protect the brand?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and we've wrestled with it many hours. I suppose the conclusion we've reached is that let's not try. Let's allow people to use the rewilding brand or the sustainability brand or whatever brand you want in the way that they want to. And we're not precious about this. We're not purists. If it means that people are adopting nature recovery in their space, absolutely fine.
Yeah, but what if it's not? What if it doesn't mean that? What if it is actually damaging what you're trying to do?
Well, that's a process. And that, you know, we have to accept that people have, I guess, hijacked the word to fit their own particular narrative. We accept that fully. I would hope we can get past that. And I hope I can evidence the fact we are starting to get past it. Because when I started following this story back at, you know, in the year 99, 2000, rewilding was wolves in, farmers out. That was it. That was as mature as the conversation got. I hope we're past that. I really do hope we're past that. It suits some people to hold on to that narrative, but I think in the wider scheme of things, certainly at government level, at education level, we are past that.
Is what you want to happen achievable under the current model of land ownership? If you've got 50%, you know, of the privately owned land in Scotland owned by some like 430 families, how are you going to do what you want to do?
It definitely is achievable, because it becomes an economic, if it's incentivized enough economically, then, you know, landowners generally, not all, but generally follow the money. So it is possible. Is it desirable to have rewilding happening within that concentrated land ownership regime? That's a different question. And conversations about land reform, of course, kick in. So I don't think those two things are related, but they're not dependent on each other. One example, just literally over the trees from where we stand, Anders Paulsen. Whatever you think about Anders Paulsen, physically speaking, he has transformed the landscape that he owns. And there are other landowners doing it. There are a lot of landowners that are not doing it. But I would say I get a phone call once a week, once a fortnight, from a landowner that's curious about what rewilding might mean to them. Culturally, practically, financially, what are my options effectively under this regime? Yeah. So it is interesting.
It's very interesting. Is what you want to achieve more or less likely under private ownership rather than community ownership? I mean, the way I phrased that initial question, you would tend to assume that, you know, obviously a community would be keener on this idea. Not necessarily.
No, not necessarily. And again, I'm really reluctant to generalise. I think there is a, you know, there's an ideology around the idea of community land ownership, social justice, just transition, and we buy into that wholeheartedly. However, if you look at it from the point of view of rewilding, and I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong, but Anders Paulsen clicks his fingers and stuff happens quickly. Mm. I've sat...
Money talks.
Yeah, it does. But it's not just money. It's that ability to be agile and fleet-footed. I've sat at community land meetings and listen to the 35 people around the table, all with a different agenda, all with a different vision, try to tease out consensus. And it can be painful. So, again, it depends on, you know, is your horse in the ecological restoration stable? Is it in the social justice, community representation stable? Pays your money, takes your choice. I don't think it's either or, but I do believe, as with the so-called green lairdism, there's good and bad, and it's inaccurate and unhelpful to tar everybody with the same brush.
Yeah. Just as we were talking there, I mean, you can hear the river behind us, and there isn't an awful lot of the river at the moment because it's been such a dry summer. The banks themselves are quite exposed. You can see where small trees have actually fallen down into the river. However, the water is nice and clear. The sun is shining on these pebbled beaches and things. And by pebbles, I mean about the size of your head. These are big rocks. It's a beautiful location. It's difficult to stand here and not be optimistic. Are you optimistic?
I think you have to be optimistic because you get out of bed every morning and you have two choices. You do nothing or you do something. And you only do something if you can see a reason for doing something. And to have that reason, you have to be optimistic. You have to be confident that your vision, in inverted commas, or at least part of your vision, is possible to realise. I think, you know, notwithstanding the subject matter, the pandemic showed us that given the right impetus, it was an unfortunate impetus in that particular case, but given the right impetus, society can move really quickly and really radically. We're not at that crossroads yet with the landscape and the ecological state of the landscape, but I think we're getting there. So yeah, I am optimistic. My life consists of, you know, two steps forward, two steps back on a daily basis. But if you go back just 3 years, never mind 10 years, and I look at what's happened in that 3 years, not only physically to the landscape, but also at an ideological level, the conversations that I'm having with unlikely candidates, unrecognisable. And you only got to look at the property market in for the larger states. And again, there's a whole new conversation around should people be able to buy that sort of amount of land and what they do with it. That's a different conversation. But the reasons they're buying it now are massively different to what they were doing for even just a few years ago. So I think the whole sort of societal narrative is changing. It doesn't happen quickly, it never does, but it is shifting.
Peter Cairns there, and thank you very much to him for his time. The Scotland The Big Picture Conference takes place on Saturday, the 24th September 2022 at the Perth Concert Hall, and all the details are on their website. That's scotlandbigpicture.com. Please get in touch with us and tell us what you think about this podcast and tell us where you listen to this podcast. We do like hearing from you. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. I'm Mark Stephen, and until the next time, thanks for listening.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.